Namaste, Jai Ma. So today is the International Yoga Day, and today is the day when the Arya, the journal through which Sri Aurobindo first propagated the great ideas of the integral yoga, was announced. Of course, the first issue came out on 15th August 1914, but 21st June is the day when it was announced. And as we know, it's also the day of the summer solstice. So it's a very significant day. Now, when we talk about yoga, we naturally, there are different ways people look at yoga, countless ways. But by and large, we all agree on the term that yoga means to join, to unite. It comes from the root yuj, so yukta, to yoke together. So this is the fundamental understanding of yoga, because it means that we are incomplete, we are leading a life which is adha adhura, half life. But there is another half of our life which is somewhere else. We can put it like this. Nowadays we have this common phrase that there is the little picture in which we live, and there is the larger or the greater picture which is constantly trying to impose itself upon this little picture. The little picture is the picture which we generate with our own mind, the ego, the desire. And the larger picture is the plan which has been for us, and a constant tussle between the two, between our hopes, desires, fears, etc., with which we try to have a little picture of our own life, and the greater picture, which is the divine plan. The constant tussle between them is what generates fate. As Sri Aurobindo says, fate is truth working out in ignorance, and we can leave it at that. So the whole effort of man is that in the more he aligns with, and eventually, let's say three stages, the more we come in contact with, and next align with, and finally live and express the greater picture, that is the divine plan, or to use the more correct expression, the divine will in us, the more we will be truly closer and aligned to our own fate, destiny, will be co-creators of our destiny. Because there is already the creator of destiny, but we can resist, play at cross purposes, cross currents, or we can be aligned to it. So when we are aligned to it, we are carried very smoothly, swiftly, happily, harmoniously on the path that has been already chalked out for us. And the more we play at cross currents with the mainstream destiny of ours, cross currents through the ego, ambitions, desires, the more we are likely to flounder, deviated, distracted, and the greater the push and the blow required to put us back on trail. So that's the whole process. So yoga is to make life, really speaking, smooth, harmonious, beautiful, a life more and more divine. How? By simply aligning ourselves. So this is the basic idea of yoga, so that the highest and the lowest are in harmony with each other, if not completely joined to each other. So now from there starts the whole soulscape of yoga, or the landscape of yoga. And as man has evolved and become conscious of himself, we see different paths of yoga which have come up. So we have, in the earlier stages, we know man is conscious of the body and the bodily energies and the life energies. And so therefore, Hatha yoga, associated with the techniques of pranayama, evolves, is one of the first yogas actually given to man, because man is conscious in the body, dehi chinme, prana chinme. So this becomes the yoga, yoga where the body's energies, which are locked in activities of everyday life, are extracted through a very complex process. And when these energies are extracted, then they can be directed towards higher purposes, maybe through the kundalini, where these energies from the base of spine are taken up through the centers, and ultimately released into the highest. So this is the Hatha yoga. Whether and how many would reach that stage is a different story altogether. Then as man becomes conscious in the mind, the process, the yoga that comes into existence is Raj Yoga. Very ancient system of yoga codified by Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and but it has been existing since long, long time. And this is primarily a control of the energies of the mind, because man has become conscious of the mind. All the outward and inward going activities of the mind are controlled, and by a certain kind of mastery they are conserved, and once conserved they can be directed towards being absorbed in the supreme object or the subject of our existence, which is the self with a capital S. And this happens normally in a state of extreme absorption in the self, what is known as samadhi. Ultimately one passes out of this individual existence. Then as we evolve further, we become aware of the inner being. There is in us will, thought, feelings, not just the mind and its outward and inner activities. And as we become conscious of the inner being, the yoga that is given to man is the yoga of the Gita, the Trimarga, where our heart, feelings, emotions, our will and all the actions, our thoughts and all the activities of the mind, they are all turned and directed towards the divine personality. Because now if these parts have to be engaged, they cannot be engaged only in an impersonal self. They cannot just be absorbed in a state of samadhi in that vast impersonality of Brahman. So all these parts need their consummation in a divine personality. So that is how the yoga of the Gita, which goes beyond the mutable and the immutable into the Purushottama. So through this yoga, the end result is that one becomes conscious of the divine even while one is in a waking state. So it's a state of Jivan Mukta. So we see these three main yogas which have come. Then there is also, as man becomes aware of the nature and the movement of the energies in his nature, there is also the other yoga, Tantra, which takes up, starts from nature. Does not just withdraw the energies out of nature, but starts from nature and begins to search for the source from where all the powers of nature has come, goes through the all the various goddesses, which are the hubs of these energies, and finally to the Supreme Goddess herself, the Divine Mother. And from the Divine Mother, it finally takes a leap again into the Supreme Purusha or the Ishvara. So it is of the nature of a synthesis. So at each stage, we see these different yogas have been given to man. But then in all these yoga, the common element is that eventually the individual is a twofold thing. One is there is the individual that we regard ourselves as, that is the ego individuality, a name, a form, a different sort of identity that we carry, religious identity and national identity, various identities we carry. All of them are eventually undone and released into the one true identity of the self or the Purushottama or the divine, whatever name we call it, and thereby they are annulled. So there is the annulment eventually of the individual existence. Now this annulment, there are different viewpoints and thoughts that, well, whether there is an individual soul or not, but that's metaphysics and we need not go into that. The fact is, even if there is one behind this ego identity, there is a true spiritual identity. Even that is ultimately, like the Gita does accept, of the many Purushas, but again, not going into metaphysics. The point is that ultimately its goal is to annul itself in the divine truth, the divine reality, and be done with the bonds of birth and death, as it is called. But as we can see evidently, now mankind has moved still further. And it has begun to raise questions for which we don't find answers in all the traditional yogas. For example, one of the questions is that if individual moksha is the ultimate goal, the highest good of the individual, then why? What is the meaning of all this society, collectivity, nation, all this unit? It has no meaning at all. Actually, even humanity has no meaning at all, because ultimately an individual has to cater to his own moksha, and while he may on the way by the way, do some passing good, because all the yogas say that, you know, you should do some good, and at the highest, maybe just after realizing, as long as he lives upon earth, he does good even without trying to do so, because he becomes a radiating instrument and channel of the divine. But eventually the whole goal is to come out of this existence. So the next question comes, does this individual existence and the collective existence has any goal or purpose at all? Because if ultimately the goal is to go back to where we came from, then it is a very meaningless journey, given that it takes not 1, 2 years or even lives, but number of lives. If we go by the saying of the Tantra, then through all the 84 lakh yonis, and even as a human birth, at least a few lives, maybe 9 or 10 lives, who knows. And all these lives through which one climbs ultimately to reach back where from where one had started. So this is a yawning gap, a question mark, for which there is no answer in the traditional systems of yoga. The second whole purpose is that, okay, if that is the case, then what is all this that we see, the change that is happening in earth and creation, should we be concerned about with it at all, or is it just a meaningless change? Nature is constantly moving, there is change happening, so just be detached and look at all this with an impartial witness eye, indifference. That is the master movement, should be the master movement of a soul that is seeking mumukshatva, that is that which is seeking release. So again, that becomes a very strange paradox, that if really this whole thing has come out of the divine, as ultimately we are told, and logically also, because there cannot be two sources of existence. So in that case, who puts us into attachment? Who puts us through the rigmarole of desire? Who puts us into the turbine engines of creation through which we move helplessly like a fly on the wheel? And who puts us through all the suffering and pain? Even if we say about the law of karma, then the law of karma is only when we have entered into existence. There is no original karma of the soul which has plunged into it. So who pushed us in it? And once we are in it, then the whole chakra of karma starts, and through all the war and misery and pain. So it makes God himself a very strange sort of creature. The creator himself is very strange, that someone who would push us into hell and then say that, well, after maybe thousands of years, you will come back to this state of bliss, and that's your enough reward. So obviously, human beings have evolved beyond the stage of a blind acceptance that, well, there is a Maya which has somehow come across on Brahman. So now, because man has become aware not just of the inner being, as we see during the time of Gita, these are the questions of Arjuna which reflect the inner being or the inner processes going on in the average representative humanity. Now, human beings want to understand what is matter, what really is the destiny of the earth, what is the meaning of society, is there a consummation towards which the world is moving. So he is becoming conscious of an inner subjective self. And accordingly, the yoga that is given to him is what we call as the integral yoga or the supramental yoga of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So this is the background. So we have to look at Sri Aurobindo and the mother's integral yoga is something which is evolved, and as humanity evolves, a new yoga is given. It's not like on the same parallel lines, there are several options and you choose one of them. We will choose based on our evolutionary necessity. To give just one example, and which also connects with the integral yoga, someone has asked today itself that, well, if I have to first realize the self, Sri Aurobindo himself says first realize the self, and then you can talk about the transformation. So why not I realize the self through the swiftest method? And according to that person, it is the method of self-inquiry. Now, it's not about agreeing or disagreeing to which method is better. But the point is that he says, that point is very valid, that why not first realize the self by whatever means? And then we will talk about manifestation and transformation. The problem there is that in all these specialized methods, we are talking as if, it's a few year journey. It's several years of his soul preoccupation. I mean, look at Raman Maharishi, look at Sri Ramakrishna, look at the Buddha. what kind of sincere seekers they have been, and what it took them to really realize that state. Even Swami Vivekananda, and in fact Sri Ramakrishna says, I have locked that door of self-realization, the highest for you, because you have the work to do. So there is, it's not an easy thing. And normally when we take to a realization of the self, which is also the first step in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, well, we may use the word divine self, then the path which is taken in the traditional yoga is by either denying nature or by a kind of progressive attrition. For instance, if I go by the path of the jnana, then I have to perforce ensure that the demands of my emotions, the leap of my emotions, my passions for work and all these things are gradually, the energy is diminished, and all this energy is directed toward the mind and inquiry and the buddhi and the intellect, and through this toward the greater self, and from the greater self, if we are very fortunate, towards he. So this is the process which is used. So these other parts suffer from a diminution. Now what happens when there is a diminution in these parts, and after 10 years, if one is lucky, 12 years, one realizes the self, or maybe a few years, by the very fact that one has relatively denied these parts. Similarly to the bhakta, it applies not only to the jnana yogi, but to the bhakta. Bhakta denies the mind. He says, I don't question. I don't need to have, I have no riddles to be solved. I believe, I have complete faith that this is a divine creation, it's his leela, and I just love my Lord and want to merge in him. So what he has done, the mind and it's the questioning intellect, the intellect which would normally inquire, that is stifled. The impulse to work and serve, that is stifled. And eventually, I'm talking of a line of bhakti, eventually he does realize and he is lost in that ecstasy, in that bhava samadhi. But all the rest is now stifled. So man's total personality does not engage in the yoga, and hence if we talk after that about doing God's work in the world or manifesting the divine, then it becomes very difficult because these parts have been not used. It's like if you don't use a pen in the house, you don't use an equipment which is there with you, it's simply rust. Even a pen would stop functioning, its ink dries up, and even though the ink is full, you cannot use it, you have to eventually throw it away. So it is true that the goal of Sri Aurobindo's yoga is, after realizing the divine in the heart as the psychic being, and from the psychic being the immanent divine, or going above the head into the cosmic and the transcendent, but yet it is not achieved by excluding nature. So we see in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, first of all, the goal is different and the method is different. So what is the difference of the goal? The goal is not an individual mukti, though mukti is important. It's an important step, as we have just been saying, because one who is not free cannot free nature, cannot free truly be an instrument of the divine. By that is meant is that if he is not free of his own opinions, viewpoints, conceptions, preferences, etc., etc., when the divine influx starts, it will all get diverted somewhere or the other, or distorted, or he will get distracted. The divine energy may even sometimes go into aggrandizing the ego, that I am a yogi, I am someone, something. So therefore, it's very important to understand that along with realizing the divine self, one has to simultaneously work upon nature. So in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it's not just liberation of the individual soul into mukti, but also liberating nature from all its limitations. So what are the limitations of nature? Before we can talk about nature becoming an instrument and a channel and transform nature, liberate it from all its distortion. It's like sieving through many things which are right now in nature, in action, we find distortions because of primarily the desires and ambitions and jealousies and fears and hate and grudges and God knows how many things. With mind, certain one-sided opinions, viewpoints, the tradition in which we have grown up. I'll give just one example. All of us love our tradition. I myself, the Vedas are to me so beautiful and sacred. because I have grown up here. But at the same time, I cannot deny the fact that when I read about, let's say, Chaldea, I read because mother spoke about Chaldean civilization which existed. And when I read about it, I found that these people, actually, they were exactly saying the same thing what is there in the Vedas. They speak about the upper hemisphere, they speak about the lower hemisphere, they speak about the celestial beings, they speak about ignorance, they speak about the covering over the individual soul, they speak about freedom from ignorance, they speak about joining the divine self, and they actually speak about manifesting. So, actually, we have to liberate the mind from all these one-sided viewpoints which come in. Now, these viewpoints are necessary when you are ascending a step, because one by one you take the steps which are right in front of you. So you take those steps. But when you go to the summit, you discover that there are many, many steps from many sides which are leading there. So the mind has to grow very wide and supple. In other words, while we use a method, we are not tied to a method. Say, for example, that somebody uses a certain ritual. So it's important to understand it's not a new religion that Sri Aurobindo is giving. Say, for example, if one practices a certain ritual, prayer, says a prayer in a certain way and receives a response. Now, if he makes these rituals and these prayers that, well, everybody will receive a response if one does it, then one is actually forming a religion. And this is done so commonly, so unwittingly, as if God was waiting for that formula. And I often say this to people, that, well, if you are trying to say that it's your ritualistic prayer and worship that brought the result, then tomorrow who prevents an AI-generated robo to do the prayer and get the result? Why need a human being at all? Why need a conscious relationship with the divine? Now, this is important for us to understand. This may be good for me. And I'm saying this because I see so many times, you know, in a collective meeting that, you know, people start that we'll chant Om 12 times. Now, because 12 times takes time, so we went gone on to, we'll chant Om thrice. Now, Om may work wonderfully for an individual. But the moment we say that everybody will chant Om, everybody closes the eyes and starts chanting Om, it's very good. I am not saying it doesn't generate a good atmosphere. But the power of Om should be such that one person with all his heart chants Om once and the divine manifests. That is the power within it. But it is lost, dissipated because of all these, the people with all kinds of thoughts going on in the mind. So first thing we need to understand that yoga is primarily an inner process. It's not so much an external ritual, an external method. You know, you do this, you have to do that way. It's the inner process. The divine responds. He's a living conscious being. So Sri Aurobindo speaks of forming a very living and conscious relation with the divine, not only in terms of our soul connecting with the divine, but our nature movements also. But how will nature connect if it is very limited, if it's fixed in grooves of habit, fixed in grooves of thought? So in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, we see there is a movement of rejection. So rejection basically is what? Rejection is not that I reject life. No, I reject all that distorts life, all that gives it a coloring, all that gives it a kind of angle of deviation. Now, why this is important? Because when the divine influx starts, then if nature is still clouded, if nature is still full of all these little grains of sand, then it will start distorting the divine truth when it comes. So we have first the aspiration for the divine. No method or any method, whatever nurtures the aspiration, doesn't matter. He understands, so she understands. She or he is not dependent on, okay, he sat in meditation at such and such a place, at such and such a time, was doing this particular mantram, this particular japa in so many times. Well, if that be the case, then we are not dealing with the divine, but with a computer. So we need to understand the divine is not a supercomputer, and that's what is the, he is much, much more. And that's the beauty of that story where the Jnani who is doing tapasya, following a certain method, and there is a bhakta who is simply ecstatically contemplating the Lord, a story which Sri Ramakrishna has narrated, and Sri Aurobindo has ratified it. He has said, yes, that's true. So Narad is going, and they both ask from the Lord, how long will it take for us to realize the divine? So he comes back and to the Jnani he says three more lives. And the Jnani gives up. He says, such a difficult sadhana I have been doing. Three more lives. Oh my God. Okay, I think now this life I leave it. I have done enough. And let me just go about and lead a normal life, which I missed out upon. I need to catch up on it. And then I'll see in the next three lives. Anyways, I'll realize because there's the assurance of the Lord. Whereas the Bhakta, he says, oh, my Lord will meet me. He says, yes, but after as many leaves on the tree, which are plenty. And this man is happy, happy beyond measure that he will meet me. That's enough. And just then the Lord appears. So we need to understand that sadhana is not a set of methods. Sri Aurobindo says, all methods and no methods, it's the sincerity of the aspiration. So as Sri Aurobindo says that the divine responds not in the measure of the sadhana, but in the sincerity of aspiration. Now, whether the aspiration is sincere or not, nobody can know about it from the outer movement, but it's an inner state. So sincerity of aspiration is the first thing, and this aspiration can be lit in every possible part of the being. So aspiration in the mind for knowledge. Why? Not because I'll become a knowledgeable person, but because one wants to know the divine. The divine is the one object of one's life. One wants to know the divine, and by knowing one can love the divine better. And then again, aspiration in the heart is seeking for the divine love, for perfect love for the divine, and an aspiration in life to serve the divine, and aspiration in the body to find its own consummation in the divine so that it can become a perfect instrument and channel for the divine. So there is a simultaneous working going on by the action of aspiration, both within the soul, which is in the depths of the heart, as well as in nature. So this aspiration means we are carrying the sadhana simultaneously together on the inmost self as well as on nature. We are not drying nature. We are not refusing to eat, but the food becomes a means that may it create in me all the elements which are helpful to the sadhana. One is not running away from physical exercises or games and sports, but one does that with the aspiration that the body may develop, become strong and supple, and become an instrument, a conscious instrument of the divine. One is not running away from intellectual activities, taking them as meaningless pursuits, but one is reading, studying, not only books of yoga and the scriptures, but science, so that one can, this science itself, scientific knowledge can expand beyond its limited frontiers and be at the service of the divine. One continues to engage in art and music, but not just because one will become an artist and a great musician, appreciated by others, hold concerts and sell his paintings or music, but because through art and music, it will be one more way of worship of the divine, and they can become means of expressing the divine beauty and the divine ananda in the world. So it's, in the Gita it is said, sarva bhavin. We can say sarva bhavin, sarva karmena. Gita also speaks about sarva karmani. So it is both which is going on together, sarva bhavin as well as all the actions. One is turning toward the divine, but with the aspiration. So it's giving to the divine, but with the aspiration that may all these actions of nature, movements of nature, become more and more a worthy instrument and channel of the divine action. This one part. Second is the rejection. So again, normally what one has to reject is ignorance, which has come over the soul. And that ignorance is basically the ego and the desire self. Basically the ego and the desire self, which is right in front, which diverts everything, gives us the false idea of the self that I am this. So of course that has to be rejected. But along with that, there are many movements, because one may, for example, reject the ego self and say, well, I am nobody. And yet allow all kinds of forces to pass through oneself without even noticing. One can say, well, I am in search of the self. How does it matter? Whether, in a certain moment I get angry. You see, there are people who find the self also and they get angry. They suddenly are overtaken by certain movements and they say that this is simply a movement of nature. This is not me, because I have found myself. or I am finding myself, I am seeking myself. So what is happening in the fields of nature doesn't concern me. So one has to reject even in nature. Not just it's enough to reject ignorance in general, but reject the lower movements or the ignorant movements of the heart, which vitiate, love, and this chalice has to be cleaned up. So this is the process of purifying. So rejection has also to be integral. And then finally surrender. So one is surrendering, again, the core, central self, the Jivatma, at the feet of the divine. But also surrendering of the mind. What it means is that whatever I know till now and whatever I yet may know is nothing compared to the infinity of knowledge and the truth which is beyond knowledge and vision, and where it, you know, it rests in silence, is nothing. So it's a state where one is completely in front of that, you know, burning home of truth, where one is not trying to use just one's own analysis or one's knowledge that I have read the Vedas, the Upanishads and the Gita. But if one is not humble enough, or Sri Aurobindo and the mother, if there is no humility, then true knowledge cannot find room. So one has to be surrendered in the mind that, well, whatever I may know, I should be ready to drop that entire thing next moment if a new knowledge finds space into the room. So this mind has to become quieter, if not silent. The more the mind becomes quiet, the more it is ready to surrender and open to the influx of the higher consciousness, the mother's working. Similarly, the heart has to be surrendered. We can't say that, well, I love the mother and therefore the mother will do whatever I wish and she is bound to do because, you know, I am the mother's child. This means that there is a lot of egoism in the bhakti, and which is very dangerous because, well, we know that the egoism in bhakti led to the fall of someone like Ravan, who was a bhakta and a mighty instrument. He was spreading the Vedas, he was great in music. But because of this egoism in bhakti, that I am a great bhakta, I am a special bhakta, and the divine is bound to listen, to respond to everything I want. If I want this, the divine is bound to give me abhiman. All these things have to be rejected from the heart, that I want this. All the wants have to ultimately not just mutate, but transmuted into simply that I want only thee. Through all relationships, through all the people I know, through all the various engagements in which my heart is connected, I want only you, to see you in all things, to live for you, to love you in all. So this is where, similarly with life and all its movement right now. So in traditional yoga, you find the self within, be concentrated and carry on with whatever work you are assigned to. Don't have ambition, but continue working wherever, whatever your duty has been. We know the story of Lahari Mahashaya, that how, you know, he was continuing to do, though he had all these magical powers, and until, you know, the brown, the white sahib, he discovered that, oh, he has such magical powers of bilocation, etc. But he was continuing to do his normal works. And there have been stories of yogis like that. But that's not what we want. That's the repetition of the same old story. Well, life itself must change into a luminous force. The acts should not be just another act, normal act of, like, let's say in the field of medicine, that I am doing exactly what everybody is doing, but inwardly I am connected with the divine. Life must discover its own higher and higher possibilities through service of the divine. And as we serve, slowly a new possibility of maybe health and healing, maybe of, you know, understanding architecture designs or whatever work one is engaged in, new forms of music, all this may emerge from life. And similarly, the body discovered the possibility of going beyond, you know, illness, death, degeneration, old age, etc. So this surrender means that always being open to the new progress. Why? Because divine is infinite. So when I give myself to the divine, it means that I am ready to receive whatever the divine wants to give me. It may be something which I like, maybe pleasant. It may be even something painful, because sometimes the instrument has to be prepared, even through pain, through, because there are spots in nature which we do not know, and that takes us to the
other aspect of yoga, that this yoga doesn't stop with the body. People think that, you know, it stops with the body. Below the body there is a subconscious, and below the subconscious there is an inconscient, which is the hub of all the darkness which keeps coming up habitually. That's why we see that even when one has been a practitioner of the yoga, illnesses can still spring a surprise. Also because there is this whole collectivity through which we are connected, and through the inconscient it's coming. So this yoga works even in the subconscious and the inconscient, throwing up resistances which are hidden there. And they are numerous, and we will not go into it. That's a vast subject which keep coming up. Even if we have cleared the frontal ground and the inner being, still they keep coming up. And that's why each individual here has to be a representative of that type of humanity, and hence he has to struggle a lot more against the challenges which normally human beings face. So this is the broad background of the yoga, why the yoga moves along such complex lines simultaneously. So all the while you are also seeking and discovering the divine self, but one is not forgetting to work on nature. And this is because ultimately the goal of this yoga is not just individual moksha, but the collective emancipation of humanity, not by vanishing into some higher state, but by becoming a vehicle to manifest the divine. So that is the Jagannath Rath. That means the society itself, not just an individual. The society, whether a nation or a group of humanity or the humankind itself, has to become a vehicle for the expression of the divine. So it's a far more difficult and complex task. And that's why we have spaces like Auroville, where, you know, experiment is going on a collective evolution of mankind. There are other places also where this kind of a thing. But even if one doesn't join these, by the very fact that one identifies, let's say, with India, so what does one do? One doesn't discard that identity, but simply uses it as a means, so that within the Indian context where one is, the yoga of the nation called India also goes on. Similarly, yoga of France, yoga of America, yoga of England, each nation has to engage in yoga by and through the individuals who are engaged in this yoga. Meaning thereby that one is the action of the divine consciousness on these nation souls, bringing out of them their higher possibilities, but also through individuals who belong to certain nations in their inner being, not just because they are born, because people may be born in India, they may have an Indian body but a European mind. But similarly, there are people who are born in Europe but have an Indian consciousness. So those who love a particular, say, soul of a nation, and thereby they are also practitioners of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Those who love humanity but are also practitioners of Sri Aurobindo's yoga, or rather, let me put it the other way, because yoga has to be the main occupation. Those who are into Sri Aurobindo's yoga and also are a lover of humanity and or love a particular nation, they don't have to discard this as if it is attachment, it's going to come in the way of the work. No, it need not be attachment. Yes, take away the attachment part, which is wanting selfish interest out of a community. But yes, turn that linkage to humanity and to a nation into a means for becoming a instrument and channel through which all the divine energies pour, and because of our connection, they go and feed the soul of a nation and the soul of humanity. So this is how this yoga starts moving on wider and wider grounds as one evolves. So one starts with individual mukti, in the sense freedom from ignorance, but then one enters into the cosmic fields of cosmic ignorance, and as one continues the yoga, the cosmic fields begin to become more and more suffused with the light of the divine. So one simultaneously participates in the individual yoga as well as the collective yoga. The more one gets rid of difficulties within one's own nature, one automatically helps in others finding it easier to get rid of these difficulties. So this just to give a broad scope of the yoga. So individual mukti, finding the divine, is one part. Then the manifestation, for which the instruments have to be ready. They have to come in contact by the divine through aspiration. Then they have to be ready to receive the divine influence. And as they receive the divine influence, they have to progress. To give an example, that let's say the mind begins to receive the divine knowledge. Now it's possible to stop there thinking that, oh, now I have reached a point
where my mind has become an instrument. Now, the moment one does it, there will be a slow downfall or there will be a static condition. Now, one goes further and further until the mind itself becomes wider, more receptive, vaster, more receptive, more plastic, and so new forms of expression. That's why Shubhendu speaks of the layers beyond the mind. And more powers from above can express through the mind. Similarly, the heart. It's not enough just to have a quiet heart. One will realize, you know, it's very easy to believe or delude oneself into believing, oh, now my love is true, my love is pure. Wait. The divine will show you where we stand. And then slowly the heart becomes wider, truer, more compassionate, deeper. So every part, the working will go on. So contact, then progressive influence, and with that, increase of aspiration, increase of surrender, increase of rejection, and increase of ultimate giving of oneself to the divine. So all capacities that grow have to be placed back at the divine feet for the divine service, until through this process, both one's individual self and the nature begin to grow more and more one with God. That's how the replacement begins to take place between the human nature, which through contact with the divine nature, the human nature begins to be replaced by the divine supernature. And that's how the change of nature, change of consciousness takes place. And at each level, there is a reversal. So as we grow, the whole outlook, inlook, everything changes. The whole thing is seen in a new light and is so amazing that, oh, I was looking at the world and myself in this way, now it's a new change. Then so on and so forth, as if one is climbing one hill after another. And this journey is a constant process. And then finally, as a result of all this change of the instruments, meaning thereby the most physical instrument. So there is the change of nature fundamentally. The mind has changed now into a mind of light, but the brain is still subject, may still be subject to degeneration. The eyesight still be subject to degeneration. The heart still subject to, you know, the limitations, unable to contain and express the tremendous onrush of divine love. The life unable to hold the divine ananda. So all these instruments, especially the physical instrument, the limbs, the head, the heart, all these start undergoing a change. So that is the process of physical transformation, where ultimately all these cells open up to the divine influx and they begin to change as a result of contact with the divine grace, divine love, divine light, divine truth, divine beauty, divine harmony, divine ananda, divine mother. So this is the broad movement of the yoga. And as we can see, how far it goes, traditional yoga stops at mukti. Nature's importance is only that it should not be an obstacle. So sattugun, most of them talk of sattugun. Many say that's also not necessary. Be so concentrated, detached from everything. Be so concentrated on your inner self that forget about everything else. Now you realize it, but your nature remains subject to all kinds of forces. Here you have to take both together, because the aim is not just individual mukti, but the divine manifestation, to be a conscious collaborator and participator in the manifestation of the divine upon earth. So the whole process is far more detailed and complex, very easy in its essence, because aspiration, rejection, surrender is the mantra which goes on along with constant remembrance and giving of oneself to the divine. And that if one continues, then eventually the path becomes wider. A time comes that, you know, this personal effort is the inner psychological effort primarily. But as one grows conscious more and more of the divine, a time comes when personal effort actually ceases. Because the divine who takes up, divine mother takes up the yoga. And then she does it all. Nothing is required after that. Because of course one has to remain vigilant for certain intrusions which may take place. But it becomes like a person who has practiced cricket thoroughly, becomes eventually, he doesn't have to worry, think, plan that, well, now I have a new fast bowler and how am I going to face? His very body develops such reflexes that it doesn't matter. He is ready to strike and is capable of striking it. So that is the state when effort ceases and the joy of effortlessness, begins. And while we may start the yoga with two moth wings or wings of a butterfly, or wings of a sparrow bird, or ultimately wings of maybe swan, but we end up by these wings being transmuted into wings of the Divine Mother's grace and love, carrying us forward, ever forward, ever forward, into endless mysteries of the Divine Mother and her infinite manifestation. Jai Ma.
This is Yogesh.
Yes, Yogesh. Please tell me.
Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, it really lays out a path of how the evolution is. But the mind says that if we look at this, all of these teachings were there and they've been available for the last few decades. Could you share some real life experiences of people who evolved to this stage and are making such a beautiful difference by being, I mean, we can obviously go back to the mother, and I'm saying since the teachings, can we get some visibility of disciples, followers who've taken this and are truly living this life that you just shared with us?
So, I understand this question has a meaning, because for a long time, disciples were very hesitant to share their own experiences. I myself, you know, used to debate about things which happened in me, with me. But then I realized that the demand of the age is very different. And an experience which has settled in the being after many, many, many years or maybe a decade, then you can share it, provided it's done in the spirit of, yes, as you said, the demand of the age. Like Vedas themselves are sharing of experiences. So there have been, fortunately, many disciples who have shared. I think there are plenty of them you will find on websites now, where there have been experiences of disciples which have been shared. There are books as well as websites on which these disciples have shared their experiences. One has to read them. Well, in my own life, I have experienced many things. I can just share just one. Again, they are there on the on interviews of my life with Narad. They are there on Aroma. And Auroville website, 15 minutes thing. So one of them I can just share with you, because, you know, speaking is one thing. So it was like, you know, this lid here, which, you know, is spoken off, and it suddenly burst open, and I actually saw it open, and there was such a, it was a glass lid, not an iron lid. It burst open, and lot of pouring of light started. And at that point of time, I used to suddenly got the urge. I was interested in writing, but writing not like lengthy things. And from that point onwards, I could write for 30, 40 pages constantly, and not like just keep on writing gibberish, but it was something which was meaningful. Prophetic insights came into that. Like I can share now, it's 86 that when I was writing, suddenly a whole piece came about India. And I remember while writing, I felt very peaceful, and I was doing the duty medical officer. Strangely, for the 3 hours that I was writing continuously, not a single patient came, God knows. And the moment I finished, then the patient came. But what was interesting was that writing eventually... there were many things which are prophetic, because I was in Punjab, and I said, well, Punjab is problem will get sorted out very soon, and we'll see problem coming in Kashmir, and when the Kashmir problem is being sorted out, we'll see problem coming in the northeast. All this I was writing then. So this was now, if I see the cycle, these things were revealed in a prophetic vein. Now I don't want to go back to that stage. And that's how the whole speech and all this started. Many things happening in the heart. Now, problem with them is that, you know, many of these experiences and changes that one observes are very, 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 very complex, very many, too many. Some of them are subjective. Say, for example, fear of snake would vanish completely. And not only vanish, but let's say, I'll give you an example. I mean, most of us are afraid of snakes, or at least no one wants to encounter a snake. And all of us, like, it's a normal fear. It's not fear in the phobic sense, but, well, nobody likes to see a snake in front. And it got replaced to that extent that there is a cobra which moves around. here, and somebody the other day was telling me, and I just felt that I can just talk to the cobra, and I just prayed that, see, people are afraid of you. They were saying, do something. I said, okay, I prayed to the spirit of cobra, prayed to the mother, and all is fine. So it doesn't, because it's right next to where my scooter is parked, but it doesn't come. Now, there are people who are not afraid of snakes, which is fine. There are some who play with it. But now this goes away. There's something very objective, which I'm aware of within me, and it shows in actions, in very concrete physical actions. So there are plenty. I mean, there are plenty of people who are experiencing the self, experience of the psychic being, experience of the self. Now, you know, one is hesitant to describe those experiences, but experience of Sri Aurobindo's Vishwarup, if you want to call it, well, that's one thing which I did have, Sri Aurobindo's Vishwarup experience by his grace, nothing else. And he is doing a yagya, and in which I am there as one of the chinna priests, and he is in his whole Vishwarup conducting. So there are plenty of them, plenty. Champak Lal ji's experiences, you have visions of Champak Lal, Amrita, plenty actually, if you ask me. So they are there, but one has to obviously go there and read them. And this is just about 100 years. But yes, disciples are very much concealed here in terms of, you know, their dress will not betray what they are experiencing inside. They will be full of joy and peace. They won't get to know. They won't be talking only philosophical stuff that, you know, this is what Vedanta says. So it is easy to not take notice of it. I know people. I know a person who actually knows without, you know, if you open a book in front, he will know what you are reading, a letter, for example, completely, who lives in the cosmic consciousness. But, you know, now people obviously, and they are all young people, not old people. I know of people who are experiencing the divine everywhere, have experienced it. So plenty. So this all I can say in maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Otherwise, it will be a Purana, Gatha in its own right. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Alokda. The question that I asked earlier was, with all this context that you shared in this call and previously also, how does one operationalize that on a day-to-day basis?
Yes, if you can guide us,
that will be very helpful.
So basically, before we talk about daily basis, one should know that, well, life is meant for finding the divine, serving the divine. Once we set the aim right, then every time as we move through life, various activities, various suggestions, various impulses will come. One has to learn to step back. This is a fundamental practice of the yoga. That instead of rushing into action, step back, discern, see. Buddhi Yoga of the Gita, that's the basic starting point, and Sri Aurobindo speaks about it, that what I am going to speak, what I am going to do, is it really going to help me in my progress? Is it going to help the world in its forward march? And if one can just do this much, mastery over actions, impulse and speech, that is going a long way, even the heart rushing to act. So step back for a while and turn inward, upward to the mother, and, you know, just withhold that movement, and many times we'll see that the whole earth goes away because it was not prompted by something deeper or higher. This is a basic practice throughout. Then yes, morning when one gets up, one just offers the day instead of rushing for anything with gratitude. Spend some time. Mother at one point recommended, just spend 10 minutes calling Ma, Ma, Ma. And it's so true. Just to, you know, think about her and wait, and then take a stretch, and then whatever one has to do. And there, even as one is engaged in various activities, still to keep an inward remembrance. It's not like one has to keep on, you know, doing with the lips or something, hold a mala. But there is a state of inward remembrance even while one is, let's say, doing a WhatsApp message, and one has to respond to, you know, life and world and things. It's not a world-shunning yoga. And while one is doing it, one is trying to keep that interiorization, and it's difficult initially, but slowly it becomes very easy. And the background state is always there, and one has to just stop for a while, and it's there. So then whenever there are moments, plenty of moments come when we are so-called free outwardly, not engaged with anything active, sit quietly in whatever posture or whatever way, wherever one is, on a staircase, on a you know, chair, one is driving a car, then activate this inner remembrance and thinking of the mother in the heart. Speak from the heart, heart by mean concentrated in the heart, eat concentrated in the heart, go to the world, concentrated in the heart. So this is the basic practice. And same thing again at bedtime, remember the mother, just spend a few minutes just thinking of ma, and then going into sleep. So this, and read something of Mother and Sri Aurobindo should be part of, I think, a very important part of everybody's practice, especially Savitri and prayers. And people often say we don't understand. Don't worry, just, you know, it's like you take a capsule, it'll do its work, whether you know its chemical content or not. Read a passage. So it helps in many ways, support the inner journey. Be in the company of those who are, you know, moving on the path, right? And shun the company of those, especially when the plant is not fully developed, who can, who are full of doubts and all things. Later on is different when the tree is rooted. Avoid places and people which in the beginning can throw all kinds of, you know, action of forces. So one has to be little careful, vigilant. And most important, the key word that they spoke of is humility and sincerity. So humility, that as one grows, the more one has to understand that one is becoming more and more a child of the Divine Mother. And sincerity to discern that am I using masks and covers, justifying things in the name of the Divine. So these are some of the key practices. Yeah.
Now I wanted to ask you
something. Yes, please.
Long back in one of your audios, I had heard this, and you had mentioned very beautifully the difference between control and suppression.
Yes. Yes, so there are two things which are used in Hindi or Sanskrit, nigraha and sanyama. So I am not using this words suppression control right now, because in psychology there is a different meaning of all these words. So nigraha is that you are externally restraining from action. So it's obviously, you restrain externally, but inwardly the mind is indulging. Is the story of the man who was observing what this lady is across. She's every so many men are going into her house, and he would say chi 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 chi, and he's a sadhu. But at the end of the day, he incurs, because his mind is full of filth. So outwardly he has restrained himself. You know, he is sadhu, but his mind is full of the filth, observing the filth in everyone. So that's called nigraha, external control, but inwardly you are. The mind is taking rasa, and in different ways it's taking the rasa. The other is sanyama, where you are not really controlling outwardly, but you are, mastery by reducing the, you know, intensity, the frequency, the kind of engagement of the mind in a certain activity, let's say a sexual activity or anger, and, you know, one understands, and one slowly, progressively works towards both inside and outside. But more importantly, inside. So, say for instance, common problems like sexuality, fear, desire and anger. One must look into the roots. That why is desire coming? Outwardly, I control my desire. But inwardly, the roots are continuing. So, one looks at the root, and one can analyze them, that look, what am I ultimately going to get? All these things ultimately will come and wither away. Basic analysis, logical, the rational discerning intellect, as it is called, buddhi. Or when one looks at desire and sees, how long can I really enjoy all this? Isn't it a waste of time and energy given the goal I have chosen for myself? So this way one starts slowly putting a brake and pressure on the desired self. And slowly as one does that, one will find that there is a decrease in the intensity and the frequency of a movement. And that's when ultimately nigraha works. When it's like, you know, how does a mongoose kill a snake, a cobra? So if you really see that fight, it is this. So mongoose neither runs away from the cobra, nor he kills him in one stroke. He tires the cobra. And when the cobra is so tired, one leap and it holds within its mouth. So you have to, when a tendency is born, it will take time, you know, for it to ultimately weaken and go away. So it cannot be that infinity of time that, okay,
I will see it when I am old. Not that way. Nor should it be that I'll never conquer, never master it. It's natural. No. So one works upon it slowly, steadily, seeks help from the grace constantly, offers it without shame or guilt. Then eventually it becomes weaker and weaker, and one day it just goes away, literally goes away, and one wonders where it has gone. So this is how the process of sayama followed by nigraha, rather than nigraha, which is a illusion, sometimes a very dangerous illusion. So people who are like sannyasis, when they come to life, it becomes very difficult for them to handle people and energies. So that's what it means. Because people, when they read a letter of Sri Aurobindo, they suddenly say, oh, I have to get rid of this. And mind blanks those things and they start believing I am out of it. And then they are seeing it in everyone around. So, he's saying if you are seeing in others, it's in you. You can't see them in others if you don't have it in you. Otherwise, you'll see it in very differently. They start condemning, blaming. That means you have never really mastered it. So, it's all there inside you. Otherwise, you'll have a very benevolent attitude as towards, grown-up would have towards a child going through a difficulty. You'll have compassion. So, that's how one has to see it. It's a long subject. I've just summarized it. Yeah.